This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. We're going to begin this hour with a source of tension on Seattle streets. That is, people living in their vehicles. Sometimes people who have no other home park illegally and don't move the car when they're ticketed. Maybe the car doesn't even run anymore. This is a fight over parking spaces and law and order. It's a cultural dispute over compassion versus indulgence. And now, an unusual King County court ruling could be a big victory for the rights of people who live in their cars. Here with the story is Seattle Times reporter Viana Davila. Hi, Viana.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What is the story of Stephen Long and his GMC pickup?
Stephen Long had been evicted from his apartment in March 2014, and since then he'd been homeless and living in a vehicle, living in his truck. He had parked that truck various places, but in October of 2016, he was parking it in, I think, 900 block of Poplar Avenue. That's just north of I-90, kind of near Rainier.
He was working at CenturyLink Field.
Yeah, that was one of his jobs. He's also a laborer by trade and does construction, but apparently he was also doing cleanup CenturyLink. Apparently, officers who had been in the area for another incident, reports of a man possibly with a knife, had encountered him. There's not necessarily reason to believe he was the man with the knife. They encountered him, discovered he had this truck, had been there for a while and said, you know, we're calling parking enforcement. It looks like you could be in violation of the 72-hour rule, which says you have to move your vehicle every 72 hours in the city of Seattle. So they call parking enforcement. Parking enforcement puts a little sticker on, says you have 72 hours to move. According to the judge in Friday's hearing, he actually, Mr. Long, removed the sticker and didn't move the vehicle. So parking enforcement officer comes back about 4 days later, apparently gave him some extra time, thinking that Mr. Long needed a part to get the truck running. And truck was still there. Mr. Long wasn't there. Apparently he was working at CenturyLink. So they towed the truck.
Why didn't Stephen Long move his truck when he was told?
You know, there was a little bit of debate in the hearing about this. The attorney for the city said that as far as they knew, the truck was running. When I spoke to Mr. Long this past weekend, he had indicated that there was some trouble with it, that he wasn't sure if it was going to run. He also said, you know, this was out of the way. This wasn't bothering anyone, and so he didn't feel it was a problem.
And by the way, we're talking about the situation that thousands of people in King County are in, living in their vehicles.
Right. The King County one-night count from January 2017, which is the most recent number we have, indicates, I think, somewhere around 2,300 people live in their vehicle, cars, RVs, all over the county.
So the city was set to sell off Stephen Long's truck if he didn't make a monthly payment plan with the city.
Right. And this would happen feasibly to anybody whose car is towed and who they don't retrieve it. So if he hadn't gone into the hearing and agreed to either pay the fines outright or entered in this payment plan, they could have put it for auction. He went to the hearing, said, this is my, I live here. Apparently the judge actually waived the ticket with the 72-hour rule ticket, which was $44. And then the fines were left. It's a little unclear to me at what point the fines were reduced. Originally, they were over $900. That's impound fees, storage fees, that kind of thing. That was later lowered to, I believe, $557. So the city sort of felt this was generous, that he was allowed to enter in a payment plan. They waived the ticket and they lowered the overall fee. But for him, he makes about $300 to $600 a month and said that this was, you know, quite a burden on him.
And Stephen Long said, this is my home.
Right.
His truck could have been up for a forced sale. And this is where his case runs into an old, what, frontier era
I think
law?
1862. Like, yeah.
It's the Homestead Act. You can't force the sale of someone's home. This is a ruling by a King County Superior Court judge.
Right. Judge Catherine Schaefer. You know, the Homestead Act has been around for, you know, 150 years or whatever that is. And basically it says you can't be forced out of your home. I think the idea is that if you do have debts that you wouldn't necessarily lose your home, lose a place of shelter. And so that's the idea. You know, I've heard talking to the city attorneys that there have been some bankruptcy hearings where a vehicle has been described as like a personal property or a home, but that's in bankruptcy hearings. He nor the lawyers for Mr. Long from Columbia Legal Services had ever heard of a case like this where a vehicle has been defined as a home by the Homestead Act. So Judge Schaefer, it seems like, has taken a pretty big step.
As I said, there's a lot of tension over people parking, living in their homes and in the Seattle area. So what are the implications of this interpretation of the 1860-something Homestead Act by this King County judge.
Right. You know, in court and later, the attorney for the city, Michael Ryan, had said, you know, look, are we saying that if, I think I use this in the story, if a person parks in front of this courthouse on Fifth Avenue and refuses to move, can we not move it? Because we fear we could be violating, you know, state constitution law, that this is someone's home. And then I think the concern is that it puts officers, law enforcement, parking enforcement, in a bind. How do you know something is someone's home? Sometimes it seems obvious. Other times, maybe it doesn't.
How would they know? What would parking enforcement have to do to decide whether this is someone's home?
Well, that's the question. I mean, if they can't reach the person on site, how do you ask that question? Do you come back? Do you circle back and say, hey, is this your home? Is this your home? I think there's a lot of implications here and certainly puts a lot of questions in people's minds about what law enforcement can do. But of course, the other side is, as you know, we have a homelessness crisis here. And where are people supposed to go? Would you prefer them to be living in camps?
Well, doesn't the city have a spot where you can park your car in South Seattle?
The Soto area, I think it's Spokane and 2nd. It's called a safe zone. Just a little history on that. Former Mayor Ed Murray had tried to address this a couple of years ago. The city opened a safe lot in Ballard. And the difference between a safe lot and a safe zone is a safe lot had 24-hour security, case manager on site, more services on site. The safe zone is basically just a lot where you're not going to be subject to that 72-hour rule. You can park safely. It's nothing like safe lot. And the city found that it was quite costly to do that safe lot. I think it was something in the neighborhood of $35,000 a month to operate that. Because RVs were coming in and they're so large, they could only house about half the number of vehicles they originally planned to. I think 20 compared to 40. Getting people into housing, which was the goal, was a bit of a slow going goal. I think out of 123 people, 29 were housed. So the city stepped back from that plan. And so there's one safe zone left. And from our understanding, the city hopes to close that by April 30th.
And then have zero safe lots, safe zones in the city?
We don't know what will happen next. You know, I've heard that Mayor Durkan is looking into a plan. I don't know what that looks like, what that will be. But certainly I've just heard from business owners in the Soto area alone, a huge amount of concern about this and what we're going to do. Because those vehicles are all over. They sometimes will plug into a business's power outlet because they want to power something. And that's caused some issues. There's been a lot of fires in vehicles in the Soto area just in February. I think there were at least 3 in vehicles. So this is a very pressing issue. So I'm very curious what the city does to address it.
Do you know what might happen next?
I don't. I think the issue is there appears to be a very piecemeal approach to dealing with vehicles in the city and the county. And let's say that dealing with an 1862 law is off the table for now, right? The legislature's almost over, so nothing's going to change anytime soon. What can the city and county do to more comprehensively deal with it? You know, you could argue there's a somewhat of a plan in place to deal with people living in camps and in tents, right? There's a navigation team. There's something. Well, what about people in vehicles? Where is that comprehensive approach to deal with them?
We've been talking with Seattle Times reporter Viana Davila. She's on the Project Homeless beat for the Times, telling us about this unusual King County court ruling, an interpretation of the Homestead Act regarding what constitutes a home. It could be a vehicle, and that has a lot of implications that we're going to follow together. Thank you, Viana.
Thank you so much.
And the city attorney's office is weighing whether to appeal that case. We'll follow it together. There's more to come on The Record here on KUOW Seattle. Stay tuned. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. In an imaginary kingdom, girls cannot be knights, only boys. So a young girl named Alana decides that in order to fulfill her dreams, she will cut her bright red hair and change her name to Alan so she can fight to protect her kingdom. Alana's story is one of 26 books written by fantasy author Tamara Pierce. Her books have inspired young girls for decades, including a young girl named Lindy West, Seattle writer and now New York Times columnist. So we invited Lindy into KUOW to talk with Tamara Pierce about inspiring girls with stories.
When I was in, I think, the 4th grade, I remember very little because I was very small. But one thing that I remember so vividly is my elementary school librarian gave me the first Alana book. You know, I must have been 8 years old. And I went home and I think I read it in a couple of hours and I went back and I just devoured everything else of yours that I could get my hands on. I think from other interviews with you that I've read, we had kind of similar experiences. I grew up with my dad would read Lord of the Rings and Chronicles of Narnia out loud to me, and I was just obsessed. But then when I read your work, it was like flipping a switch. It had never occurred to me that I could see myself or, you know, young girls and women represented so vividly and with so much humanity and depth. What got you hooked on fantasy as a genre in the first place?
Fantasy as a genre, I'd actually laid the groundwork, or rather my dad did, when I was in second grade or so with Edgar Rice Burroughs. And then I'd gone on to read fairy tales and a lot of mythology, Greek and Roman mostly, but also the Arabian Nights and Egyptian mythology. But as far as official fantasy goes, I was already writing time travel stories. And in seventh grade, my homeroom teacher, whose name may she live forever, handed me this book called The Fellowship of the Ring by a guy named J.R.R. Tolkien. And she said, give this a try. And like you, I was off to the races. I read it, finished it at 2 a.m. the next morning, cried because I thought there was no more. And then Monday, Mrs. Jacobson handed me the next two books because she knew how fast I read. And I was hooked with The Fellowship. A year later, discovered science fiction, but fantasy was where I kept coming back.
And you've talked about reading those books and loving those books, but noticing that there weren't a lot of women warriors in those books. Why were you looking for stories about women warriors?
I was looking from then on for strong girls in books, and the only place in the 60s where you could reliably find them in books for girls were in historicals. And to this day, I still reread The Witch of Blackbird Pond, Mara, Daughter of the Nile. But at the end of each of their books, they were asked to calm down and live the lives of proper young ladies or wives, in Mara's case. And they acquiesced because they felt they'd gotten a kick out of their gallop. I don't know. So I kept looking. And at first I thought I'd found her with Eowyn in The Fellowship of the Two Towers. But then at the end of the book, the third book, she gives up being a warrior to become a wife, mother, and healer. And I had nothing against those lines of work. I just didn't see why she had to give up being a warrior. But it was McCaffrey, I think, who taught me that women could be the hero of the book. And until then, I wrote Girl Knights because that's what I wanted to read.
Did it feel to you when you were writing those characters, when you were taking these strong female characters that you'd seen on the periphery of other books or sort of retired into a quiet life at the end, when you took those kinds of characters and centered them, did that feel like a deliberately political move or a revolutionary move to you, or was it just your instinct?
Well, I was angry at all those authors who had the chances to write highly active female heroes and didn't, or trashed other women. I didn't understand it, so instead I wrote what I wanted to read to entertain myself. I wasn't thinking about politics. Where I thought about politics in those days was in the fact that I'd written J. Edgar Hoover to ask what the requirements were to enter the FBI, and somebody in the FBI wrote me back that actually girls weren't allowed to be agents in the FBI in the late 60s, but that if I worked hard at school and graduated high school, I could apply to become a secretary.
Wow.
And what encouraged my wrath was that my principal patted me on the back once and introduced me to a guest to the school as our little women's libber. And those kind of things really chapped my nether parts. What I wrote for a long time was somebody very focused on what she wanted to achieve. She wasn't thinking of other women at the time. She wasn't thinking of breaking down barriers. She was just thinking of doing what she wanted. And then when I was in 10th grade, I stopped writing my own fiction for 5 years. I was blocked. I wrote satire for a school paper. I wrote homework, of course. Has to be done. Want to go to college? Okay.
What brought you back to writing?
I have no idea. All of a sudden, I had this idea for a story, and it was 5 pages, and I sweated blood, but I finished it. It was a story about a rustic deputy who thought he could take advantage of 2 hippies driving down the road, and he thought the guy was his problem when it was the woman, and she turned out to be a devil. So served him right.
Served him right.
Yeah.
I'm talking to Tamara Pierce. She's a young adult fantasy writer whose books center around young girls adventuring. Her first book, Alana, The First Adventure, tells the story of a young girl who wants to become a knight, but can't because girls aren't allowed to be knights. Did you ever think that? I mean, that sounds like your desire to be in the FBI. Did you think about pulling an Alana and going to the...
No, by then I started to learn a bit more about what the FBI was doing, especially their boss. But I also, you know, kids, you want to try different things. I said I wanted to be the first woman president and got laughed at. I said I wanted to be an attorney and my own mother laughed at me. So I decided that I would go to college and become a psychologist. Evidently, that was okay. But my mother claimed to be, well, she was a feminist. She was hardcore. And I wasn't. I had a sense of humor. It was my doom when I entered the Penn Women's Center in college because, well, they were awfully dedicated. And I was dedicated too, but I had a boyfriend and I had a sense of humor. And neither worked out as far as my fellow feminists were concerned.
Oh, I didn't realize that you couldn't have a boyfriend and a sense of humor and be a feminist.
This was the 60s.
Maybe times have
early
changed.
Early 70s, and this was when Catherine MacKinnon and other women were rising to the top and when marches were being held saying sex period is an assault.
Sure, sure.
And I wasn't about to agree.
Sure. So you write very frankly and I think beautifully about the trials and also the joys of being a young woman. So you write about puberty, you write about periods. And I'm curious, what's your male fan base like?
Well, my male fan base, I'd say it's about a quarter to a third. A great many of them have been introduced to my books by girlfriends or wives or mothers. The younger ones tend to have been introduced by sisters or mothers, and they're absolutely wonderful. They tend to be very thoughtful. They tend to ask women for their opinions and listen, and they have their own thoughts, their own minds. That was just a side benefit as far as I was concerned, but I wanted guys to read them because they were adventures, not because they were girl polemics. Alana herself would be very confused at the idea of being a feminist icon. What I was writing, female and male, was characters that my readers would feel that they could turn the corner and find people they would hang out with. I have taken some grief about boys reading my stuff. One very notable incident that turned unpleasant. A teacher asking his boys, weren't they embarrassed by a book with girls having periods.
I mean, they live in a world with girls having periods.
That's exactly what I said. You know, excuse me, but Are you going to say to your girlfriend or your wife, you don't want to know about that stuff? This happens to all of them, you know. So that afternoon was not one of my better ones.
I mean, that seems like one of the real tragedies of art and literature being segregated by gender in this way, where boys are taught that it's not interesting or fun or cool to read books by and about women. I mean, that creates some real divides in terms of how we relate to each other in our real lives.
It does, but I found one way to get around it. A mom came to a book sale where at the time I had 17 books out. And she was there and she says, oh, here's the writer and she'll sign your book if you buy one. And she asked me, what would you recommend? And he was looking at the sprawl of my books with all those girls in armor, admittedly, but they were all there on the table. And you could see it's a girl book as if it were tattooed on his face. And I pointed to the first Kel book, which has Kel with a black eye holding kittens and with a bird perched on her. And I said, in this one, she and her friends, who are pages, fight off giant, hairy, 4-foot spiders with green webs and steel teeth. And he looked at it and he said, cool. And I pointed to the second one, and there's Kel on the rock top with her spear in her hand. I said, in this one, she and her friends are cornered by enemy soldiers, and she has to get them to unite and fight together and retreat until they can get to a position they can hold against this enemy until their friends arrive. And he didn't see anything else, but his jaw dropped. And the third one, she not only babysits a baby griffin, but she is the assistant to the knight commander of the king's private guard. She fights a centaur, and she comes to individual combat with a giant monster made of steel with razors for teeth and claws. And his mother looked at him, and she looked at me. She says, we'll take all three. Sometimes you just have to know how to talk to them.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing about your writing is it definitely delivers on action and monsters and adventures. I feel bad if there are any boys missing out on this because they're just really fantastic adventure stories, but with a level of emotional intelligence and emotional depth, especially in the relationships between the characters that I don't always, I think... Well, I don't want to generalize, but sometimes it's rare to find that level of emotional intelligence from men.
Well, they have it. They've just been taught to be afraid to mention it. When I wrote Alana, I was the first women were entering West Point and the naval academies and struggling there. And when I began Kel, it was just after Shannon, I'm forgetting her name, had tried to get in, had gone all the way to the Supreme Court to get into the Citadel, which was the last all-male military academy. And she succeeded. And she went in, and she lasted a week. And the only thing I could figure was that she had thought that once she was in, the hate would stop instead of getting worse. The next year, Nancy Mace and another woman went into the Citadel, and both of them succeeded and triumphed and graduated. Most of my books, because of the military element, most of the secondary cast is male. I have to write my boys like regular boys. So Kel and Alana, Alana because she's little, get a certain amount of grief. That's what happens among groups of boys. That's how our boys are unfortunately trained. And I was hoping that perhaps if they saw it, they might rethink it.
What has been the response to those aspects of your books? Because I mean, people, I imagine, get uncomfortable with talking about teenagers and sex. And
yeah.
Have you had pushback from publishers or just from readers?
From readers. One girl really disapproved of the whole menstruation thing. I've had two, not bannings, but censorings in America, and nothing ever came of it. I had one contemporary teen romance writer. There were a group of them being interviewed by School Library Journal, I think it was, about the reaction to romance and physicality in their books. And she said, "I don't understand it. Tammy Pierce writes worse things than I do all the time, and nobody ever says anything to her about it." And it's because people think fantasy is safe, which is the biggest mistake of all, because fantasy and science fiction and horror are not safe. They are rebel genres. I'm not good at making stuff up. I borrow from the real world. And what I borrow from is not pretty.
You know, so I write political columns. I write nonfiction.
Yeah.
And especially the last year or so.
Oh, please. Do we have to?
I'll be gentle. You know, I look at my job and what I do. Every week I have to come up with something new to say about the government, which is... what do you say? It's almost impossible. Over the past year, I've been thinking about how much of our political discourse is, you know, very polarized groups of people yelling at each other.
Yeah.
And I'm a part of that. You know, I try to be smart and nuanced and generous and compassionate. And when I look at what happens when my work goes out into the world, the people that are inclined to agree with me consume it and like it. And the people that have already made up their mind that they disagree with me don't read it. And I've just been thinking more and more about how powerful fiction is and how powerful narrative is in the way that it can get inside of you and sort of change your mind from the inside out. You know, it teaches you how to treat other people and how to have empathy. And so I guess what I want to know is, what kind of stories do you think we need to save us, and will you save us?
Yeah. Oh, I think a lot of it's out there. We're seeing a lot more, not enough, but a lot more writing about race. And because it's written around characters like that are like real people, it burrows in deeper. We're seeing a lot more about people who are ill. People who are coping with family members who are ill. People who are coping with family members who are ill and there's no money coming in. If I could bear to write about contemporary poverty, I would, but I can't because having been there and done it, I can't. We're seeing more about the dialogue between young people because I can't say rightly or wrongly because they're right. They don't believe older people listen, and they're right. They don't believe that older people have any respect for their opinions, and they're right. They don't believe older people have any kindness or mercy, except for a very few sometimes, and they're right. So if the change is going to happen, that's where they're going to find it.
Tamara Pierce, thank you so much.
Thank you. This was great. I enjoyed chatting with you.
I enjoyed chatting with you, too. Thank you.
Feminists rule.
Yay!
And on KUOW's The Record, we're about to enjoy chatting with former U.S. Labor Secretary Robert Reich, who has a new book out called The Common Good, and he thinks that's something we actually can restore in this country. We'll find out how in just a moment. Stay tuned to The Record. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Well, the Mariners can't seem to make the playoffs the traditional way. Now they may have a supernatural weapon, a fountain of youth. I return you to the year 2001.
Ichiro, 0-for-3 in his Mariner and Major League debut. The 2-1 pitch. Swung on, ground ball back up the middle. That's into center field. And Ichiro is on the board with his first Major League hit. A sharply stroke shot right back up the middle off Miguel Tejada, the shortstop, and on into center field.
Ichiro Suzuki was already not a kid when he joined the Mariners in 2001. He was an established star in Japan. He's 44 years old now, never stopped playing. He's been with the Miami Marlins, but Miami has let him go. And he has said he wants to play till he's 50. He'll go back to Japan if he has to. But what if he could come back to Seattle? It makes sense. Mariner outfielder Ben Gamel is hurt. Ichiro Suzuki is immortal. And now ESPN says the Mariners are working on signing him. So it's either Ichiro or me or Robert Reich. I think any of us could potentially be the next Mariner outfielder.
Easily. So. Easily. I mean, just give the word.
I'm joined by former U.S. Labor Secretary Robert Reich. Good to have you in Seattle. Welcome.
Well, it's great to be here, Bill. Thank you.
Big league sports. There's a case where people come together for a kind of common good. You have Mariners fans with nothing else in common coming to Safeco Field, and they stand up and salute a flag, although the flag doesn't work as well for you if you're poor or a minority, and why should undocumented immigrants have rights, and why doesn't the government care about my rights? He's not my president, and why is this anthem only sung in English? Well, don't ask the media. They're all liars. So much for the common good. Your new book is called The Common Good, which is why we're discussing this, and you say Americans have lost sight of the common good, but we can restore it.
Yes, I think we will. And it's an upbeat book, and people are surprised it is. And they're surprised, particularly in this era of Trump, that I am optimistic. But, Bill, I am. I think that, you know, say what you want about him. The president has at least brought us back to first principles. And one of the key first principles is what we owe one another as members of the same society. I think, you know, I came of age at a time when John F. Kennedy, in his inaugural speech, asked us to ask not what America can do for us, but what we can do for America. And at the time, that was the kind of an admonition that struck a chord with the country. We had been, my father's generation had been through the Depression and World War II, and we were really at the dawn of another age. We didn't know what it was, but here was this young president, John F. Kennedy, asking us to find the common good, to identify it. What were the ideals that kept us together and that defined what we owed each other?
Well, how do you compare that inaugural speech to this inaugural speech? Here's President Trump saying that there's at least a perception that the elites have changed the rules to benefit themselves. This is President Trump.
The establishment protected itself, but not the citizens of our country. Their victories have not been your victories. Their triumphs have not been your triumphs. And while they celebrated in our nation's capital, there was little to celebrate for struggling families all across our land. At the center of this movement is a crucial conviction that a nation exists to serve its citizens. Americans want great schools for their children, safe neighborhoods for their families, and good jobs for themselves.
So there's President Trump saying the elite, the establishment, have not worked for the common good, and it's time. I'm here for you. I'm almost a beyond party. I'm here for you, the people. What do you make of his take on the common good?
Well, 2016 was clearly and we'll go down in history as a presidential election in which most people, I think, were fulminating against the establishment. I remember in 2015, even in 2014, I was out in the hustings in so-called red states on various projects, and people would tell me that they were fed up. They just felt that the elites of America had turned their backs on them. And I was talking with Democrats and Republicans and talking with people who were, you know, retailers and merchants, but also farmers and, I mean, all kinds of people. And it was very well and deeply felt that the establishment was corrupt in some way. And I understood it because for 30 years, most Americans had not had a raise. Adjusted for inflation, wages had been stagnant. Incomes had been absolutely flat. The nation had been doing much better, but most of the gains had gone to people at the top. And so even though the pundits in Washington in 2014, 2015, 2016 were saying, well, it's going to be Hillary Clinton versus Jeb Bush, what I was getting out in the country was something very different. And by late 2015, people were saying, well, I'm going to vote for, can't make up my mind between either Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders. And I'd say, what? I mean, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, they're on different planets. Mm-hmm. But actually, to many people, both of these gentlemen were going to shake up. They were going to shake up the government. They were going to shake things up and maybe return us to an earlier conception of democracy, when the government really was of and by and for the people.
Well, you're pointing to money there, the lack of a raise. A lot of people also see a culture war there and white identity politics.
Well, I think the white identity politics emerges from the frustrations and angers and insecurities of an economy that's not working for most people. That is, it's easy for demagogues, and let's not get too political now, I don't need to, but it's easy for demagogues to latch onto those frustrations and channel the resentments toward either foreigners or Mexican-Americans or Mexicans or African-Americans or whatever we want. In other words, racism and xenophobia aren't new to America. We've had them for 240 years. What's new is the frustration that enables politicians to use that xenophobia and use that racism to build their base. And that frustration, in turn, is based on economics.
I'm talking with Robert Reich, former labor secretary. He's a professor of public policy at University of California, Berkeley, and he's in town to go to Seattle's First Baptist Church on Capitol Hill. You're speaking there at 7:30 this evening. And we're talking about his new book called The Common Good. So let me challenge your premise a little bit to ask, when was America ever devoted to the common good? As you just said, racism and xenophobia are not new.
Well, the difference, I think, Bill, is that in the years following World War II, again, that generation that had gone through the Depression, understood our interdependence, had gone through the World War II, they began to rebuild the country. We rebuilt Europe, but we invested in highways and bridges and an education system second to none, public higher education all over the country, civil rights, voting rights, Medicare, Medicaid, the Environmental Protection Act. Now, it's not that we had eradicated racism or sexism, of course not, but we at least were seeking to achieve our ideals. We were on the road. Inequality was very, very low at that time. Most Americans were gaining, even if they were in the bottom fifth, they were gaining from an economy that was doing well. It was only really starting in the 1980s that we began to give it up. And in the book, I go through reasons why. To resurrect the common good, we've got to understand what happened to it. There were many kind of interactions. They are somewhat complicated, but not all that complicated. Basically, the ethic of we're all in it together was replaced by you're on your own and get what you can, regardless of the cost. Whatever it takes to make profits, whatever it takes to gain political power, whatever it takes to corrupt the system so you can be on top. Donald Trump is the consequence of all of this. He is not the source. The source actually was 30 years before. Sadly, I saw it. I had a front row seat in part of it because I was Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. And both parties are to blame in part, but the blame goes beyond the political process. It really goes to CEOs and Wall Street and a lot of people who turn their back on the common good.
Well, you're calling this an optimistic book, Secretary. This is Robert Reich. But a pessimist would look at what you just laid out and say, okay, so we really came together after a world war, after a Great Depression, and in the middle of an unprecedented economic boom that we probably won't see again for lots of big systemic reasons. So what makes you so optimistic that the common good is something we can restore in this country?
Well, I'm optimistic. I mean, look around us. Look at those young people in Florida, the kids. from Lakeland, Florida. Look at their
site of the mass shooting.
Yes, and look at their articulation, their commitment, their extraordinary dedication to the public good, the common good. I teach and have had the privilege for much of the last 40 years when I wasn't in Washington of teaching college students, and I have not come across a generation of 18 to 22-year-olds more committed, more dedicated, more concerned about the common good than this current generation.
Well, may I ask you for an example beyond some traumatized kids coming out of a horrific mass shooting? I'd love another example.
Well, look at the Me Too movement. I mean, that, it's not that women suddenly were abused and harassed. No, it's that coming out of a now, there's something about right now, the era we're living through, that is causing people to stand up to abuses of power, abuses of authority, and say we're not going to take it anymore, and we owe each other much more than this. We're much better than this. Look at what's happened in a very, very short time over the last few years with regard to gay marriage, something we thought was not really possible. And yet, not only was it possible, but it is now the law of the land. I could give you many, many other examples.
But are you giving us a liberal's optimistic take on coming together for the common good with Me Too and gay marriage? I mean, isn't part of our problem that conservatives hot under the collar are seeing this as quote-unquote identity politics in a divisive way?
Well, the point is it's not identity politics. In fact, I was talking to a fellow not long ago named David Bratt, who is a member of Congress. He's officially, according to the Conservative Digest, one of the two most conservative members of Congress. He's a Republican, 7th District of Virginia. And the subject and the reason I was meeting him was because I want to get big money out of politics. And I heard through the grapevine, the political Washington grapevine, that he was very interested in getting big money out of politics. And we spent all afternoon talking about our mutual commitment to getting rid of crony capitalism. Now, remember, this is the second most conservative member of Congress, a Republican. And he and I are talking about how we can possibly get big money out of politics. This is new, Bill. This is not something that I experienced 3 years ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago. There's been a steady deterioration in these kinds of conversations and this kind of movement. It's not just on the left. In fact, I think that the Me Too movement is not a lefty movement. It is a movement of women in all circumstances who really are not going to take it.
Maybe it's just the way we talk about it. I agree with you. I'm not calling it identity politics or divisive, but it sure seems like that's the popular take.
Well, I think identity politics is a misnomer. I think it's about abuses of power. And I think it's taking power back, whether you're talking about economic power or power at the workplace, or you're talking about the power of the National Rifle Association over our decisions as a country. The vast majority of Americans, by the way, vast majority, according to the polls, want background checks, universal background checks, for example. Don't think assault rifles ought to be easily available. I mean, people are reasonable on these issues, but the National Rifle Association, backed in large part by gun manufacturers, are not having anything to do with it. Well, maybe they ought to listen. Maybe in fact Americans are beginning to stand up to all of this.
But Secretary Reich, we also have, if you were to ask to survey people, you'd see bipartisan consensus on what you just said, crony capitalism. But that was President Trump's populist promise that I'm above left, right. I'm a populist. I'm on your side, and we'll drain the swamp and defeat crony capitalism. Where's your evidence that this is going productive places?
Well, he made the swamp bigger. I mean, he didn't drain the swamp. He put a dam, an even bigger dam, in the swamp. I was in Washington just a couple weeks ago. Every lobbyist I ever came across in Washington is now in government. The money is flowing, but there's a kind of a Waterloo moment there brewing as well. I mean, Jared Kushner and others, the conflicts of interest, people are just, even conservative Republicans I come across, they said, I just can't stand it. I mean, it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing to have that going on.
Robert Reich, former U.S. Labor Secretary under President Clinton. He's at Seattle's First Baptist Church on Capitol Hill tonight at 7:30, and his new book is called The Common Good. What's a country that does, you think, does act under the common good? What's your role model?
I think the role model really is the United States, has to be. And it's times in our history when we understood it, when we lived it. People say to me, well, what aren't we losing our national identity? And there is a very broad and widespread concern that we are losing our national identity. But what is our national identity? What has it ever been? Has it ever been the whiteness of our skin or our Christianity or the fact that we were born in the United States? Or those are not national identity.
For a while, it was about giving us huddled masses.
Exactly. Our national identity is about a set of ideals that we inherited, ideals that were hard to achieve, have not been achieved, but were even hard to write down. I mean, the idea that it's we the people coming together for a common purpose, not I the selfish jerk wanting to make more money. That's not why we are together. We when Lincoln talked about a government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from this earth, he was reflecting ideals that he felt and understood had been handed down for generations. It's a privilege, a legacy that we all have. You know, equal opportunity, equal political power. No man is above, or no person is above the law.
But of course, we started out with that with that not ever really being true, and there was slavery and massacre, and then after Lincoln, there was Jim Crow, and you've described this period after a horrible world war and depression, and as we said, an unprecedented economic boom. That was the time America lived up to its ideals?
Bill, don't misunderstand me, because I don't want to look at the past through rose-colored glasses.
Okay.
I'm saying that the times we lived up to our ideals were when we sought to achieve them. We have never achieved them. But the best of us and the best of our history has been when we understood how far we were from those ideals and we rededicated ourselves to those ideals. And there are particular periods of time when we did that. I think we are, if not beginning to do it already, we will do it shortly. I think that, and again, it's part, I think, due to, and again, here I want to be very careful not to sound too partisan because this is not a partisan book. But I do think that sometimes in life you only appreciate things when you lose them or you don't have them or you're in danger of losing them. And I think that issues of democracy and tyranny, issues of real American fundamental common good type ideals have been in the news and really in the fore over the past year, a little bit more than a year, under this new administration. And people waking up and saying, well, wait a minute, I just didn't know that our democracy was as fragile as it really is. This is a wake-up call.
I'm really playing the pessimist here, but I could also, you're talking about it's in the news, people are waking up, except I also imagine Americans whose idea of news is their bubble. It's their blue state or their red state. It's their social media feed. It's the, you know, they're not tuning into Walter Cronkite. How do you know that we're not just more separate and tuned out than ever?
Well, we're very divided. We're divided, as you said. The internet is creating bubbles. We are basically in touch with news and opinions that confirm our own opinions. But when I go out, and by the way, I spend a lot of time, as much possible time as I possibly can, in states that are called red states. Every time I'm invited to a public university to give a lecture, if it's in a red state, I will go. I will accept the invitation. I tell my students, and I tell students around the country that the best way of learning anything is to talk with somebody who disagrees with you. If you are simply in your bubble, you'll never learn. If you're in your bubble, you will never be tested. Your views and attitudes and opinions will never, ever come in for a rigorous test. The only way you learn, and
Secretary, I want to let you know that we're on this live clock and just have a few seconds, so I want to let you know that so you can wind up to a final message.
Well, my final message is not to be pessimistic, to keep up the fight for the ideals that really and a remarkable number of Americans share.
This is Robert Reich, former U.S. Labor Secretary, and he's in Seattle tonight at First Baptist Church on Capitol Hill at 7:30, and his new book is called The Common Good. It's a pleasure meeting you, talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
And thank you for listening to The Record, produced for you today by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jima Brempong, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. More great conversation coming your way tomorrow on The Record.